Welcome to New Thinking for a New World, a Tilburg Foundation podcast. I am Alan Stoga, your host. Each week, I bring you conversations with people who think differently about the great issues that are shaping our world. Geopolitics, disruptive tech, mass migration, the changing climate, culture wars, all of it is grist for our mill. I hope you enjoy listening. I also hope you will let me know what you think and that you join the conversation at tilburgfoundation.org. And now for today's episode of New Thinking for a New World.
5 years ago, a leading Brazilian scientist published an open letter which he titled Amazon Tipping Point, Last Chance for Action. Since then, there has been record-breaking drought throughout the Amazon, as well as record-breaking forest fires, almost all of which were man-made. From a distance, it looks to me like that tipping point when the rainforest accelerates its transformation towards becoming grasslands is rapidly approaching or could already be occurring. What does it look like up close? Francisco von Hildebrand, Pacho, has a ringside seat to answer that question. He is the leader of Gaia Amazonas, which was founded more than three decades ago, whose core purpose is to support the indigenous people in the Amazon, to help them get a voice, to help them sustain their lives. Pacho literally grew up and has devoted his entire career to that effort, which in practice means trying to save the Amazon. Welcome, Pacho, to New Thinking for a New World.
Good day, Alan. Thank you so much for having me and to invite me to all of your network. Great to be here.
Although I want to focus our conversation on what's actually happening in the forest, let's start by looking at the Amazon from 60,000 feet. What is a flying river and why should we know about it?
Right. Well, you know, I mean, back in the 80s, if you remember, there was this huge move on positioning the Amazon, and it was marketed or sold a bit like the lungs of the world. And people have stayed with this image, but the Amazon goes way beyond the Amazon, much more than being a static forest down in the South America. It is active around the world. And the Amazon, every tree of the Amazon produces clouds, produces between 1,000 to 10,000 liters of water vapor. And when you add up in trillions and trillions of trees together, you have this massive pumping system that drags water from the Atlantic across the Amazon through the skies to these clouds that are created by trees. It hits the Andes and it spreads across the Americas and the world. Actually, more water, Alan, goes through these, what we call flying rivers, through this water transportation system with vapor. More water goes through the last flying river of the Amazon than through all terrestrial rivers of the Amazon basin. And that's a lot. I mean, just to put it in numbers, that's 20% of global rainwater. That's 70% of rainwater for South America, 50% for Central America, and like that it goes. So really, the Amazon is dynamic. The Amazon goes beyond the Amazon. The Amazon goes across the Atlantic. The Amazon goes across the Americas, and it brings water to everybody, everywhere, all the time. And you just mentioned, and that really comes to the point, these fires. It's quite amazing. There's a photograph a couple of years ago when there were the big fires in the Amazon, a photograph at night. And when you see the Amazon at night, you see the southern part of the Amazon up all red and the northern part of the Amazon absolutely dark. And that's because this northern part of the Amazon is actually the last stretch of healthy rainforest that connects all the way from the Atlantic to the Andes. And that's the last stretch of healthy rainforest that upholds that last great flying river. So you can really see it. You can measure this water transportation. You can see it at night. You can really, in a tangible way, understand how we're all connected to the Amazon through water and rainfall and how we all depend on it.
Let me underline a couple of things you just said. One, of course, is that the part of the Amazon that is at least relatively intact, is the northern part of the Amazon. The part that is deeply, deeply under pressure is the southern part of the Amazon. I saw a World Resource Institute study recently that actually demonstrated that the southern part of the Amazon is already a net producer of carbon. The northern part of the Amazon, the part that you work on and essentially live in, is still a net carbon sink, which is to say it's sucking carbon out of the system.
That's right. That's right. I mean, that northern part, if you imagine the Amazon basin and the Amazon River passing through the middle, from the Amazon River upwards, that's the northern part, and that's the healthy part of the forest, where you still have the last stretch of healthy rainforest, strong biodiversity, a lot of indigenous cultures that maintain this forest. If you go further down the south of the Amazon, you find a lot of more interventions, deforestation. And there, of course, when you cut the forest, you cut the cloud makers. And when you break the cloud makers, you cut the water system. So then it starts drying out. That's why we see these huge fires. That's why you have cities like Sao Paulo with 16 million people with permanent water rations, or however we say, no, with permanent rationing. Just a couple of years ago, Argentina lost 30% of its agricultural production because of the changing water rainfall patterns. So indeed, the southern part of the Amazon is transforming. And that's what's really concerning, that we talk about the tipping point. And experts say, scientific studies say that if we reach between 20 and 25% of destruction of the forest, these water cycles, this healthy forest system will collapse.
Let's focus on that for a second, because since you already have the Amazon effectively being separated into two different realities, the southern portion of the Amazon, where the fires have been concentrated, is already tipping, it sounds like. It is already a net producer of carbon. But I want to focus on the northern part, which is still, as you've just said, relatively healthy. Why is that? Why is the north still healthy, still doing what we need it to do? And what role is your organization, your colleagues, both within Gaia Amazonas and your collaborations with others, and especially the indigenous people, what are you all doing to keep it healthy?
The northern part of the Amazon, around 67% of that area of the northern part of the Amazon is today an indigenous territory or a national park. So there has been a lot of work through the decades by Gaia Amazonas, by other partners of the indigenous organizations and of civil society, advancing in trying to protect traditional indigenous territories and protected areas in the northern Amazon. There has been a very concise effort there and a very cross-articulated effort. We work cross-border. We don't only focus in our countries, but we focus on the regional connectivity. What does it really take to maintain this biological connectivity, and how is the best way to do that? And the best way to do that, of course, is supporting local communities, is supporting indigenous peoples, is supporting people who have called the Amazon their home for thousands of years. It is an intimate knowledge that indigenous people have of the Amazon, that there is like a co-evolution, and they really understand the life cycles of the Amazon, what can be done and can't be done. And it has been an amazing process working with indigenous communities from Colombia and from other parts of the northern Amazon on how, apart from getting their land recognized, as they consolidate the local government. And I'll go back to this point in a moment to talk more about what's happening now with indigenous local governments. But as they consolidate local governments, how they bring their traditional knowledge into place, and where they have a life-centered planning, which is very different. Indigenous people remember that they were part of nature, and they plan with nature and life at the center. So if you have to build a school, if you have to build a health post, if you have to, whatever you have to do, the decision-making process of these indigenous local organizations always has life at the center. And that brings a new approach on how we can do planning development that brings a new approach on how we can govern these territories hand in hand, indigenous peoples and the state. So I think that one of the reasons why this northern part is healthier is there's been a lot of advance on securing indigenous territories, on strengthening indigenous communities to govern the territories, despite a lot of challenges, because there is a lot of challenges. But it has been really a focus area where much more work has been advanced than in the southern part. And we have to be absolutely fair as well. It's not just because of the great work we do and the indigenous communities do. The southern part has been really the target for industrial agricultural development. And that's where they've been focusing the most. So while in the southern part, there's been much more intervention, much more investment in traditional development, in agribusiness and roads and infrastructure, that northern part has been left a little bit more on the side. And that has allowed a lot of innovative processes to happen, such as land titling for indigenous peoples and indigenous governments. So it is a combination of reasons. And the last one that I would mention, it's really important as well, is that that northern part of the Amazon is the one that holds the strongest biodiversity, that holds the Amazon big, the Amazon's great flying river, and therefore it's a very strong ecosystem. It's a very resilient ecosystem.
You've talked about protecting that land, and you mentioned in passing titles, land titles for the indigenous people, both of which have been big focus of Gaia Amazonas over the years, as well as of others. The question, I guess, is how protected is protected? To have it legally protected is one thing. To have it de facto protected is quite another.
Let's break it down. How protected is protected? And to begin, it varies from country to country. Countries like Colombia, if you talk about the legal part, okay? Countries like Colombia, indigenous people own their territory by constitutional norm. It cannot be bought, sold, nor taken away for security reasons. It is bulletproof legally. Indigenous people have the right to create their own local governments with the same powers or even more powers than a local municipality. And that's very unique of Colombia. That is very unique of Colombia. And that is quite amazing because that's truly the materialization of indigenous rights, not just on the rights of the land, but on the right to govern themselves and to have a different approach to development and build policies and programs and protect their territories and address issues that come from the outside world. For instance, with all of these carbon markets craziness and carbon cowboys, the indigenous communities were under threat, were being attacked by a lot of these carbon cowboys. And the indigenous governments in Colombia took the stand, made the legal lawsuits, did local regulations. So there is a true empowerment on both how to manage their territories and their lives, but how to deal with external threats, of course, when they are within the reach of legality. You just mentioned, Alan, the critical thing here, which is the illegal governance, not the illegal powers that are in the Amazon. And that is the most complicated topic today. Because now we don't have just organized criminal groups in Colombia and in Peru. Now it is cross-border, well-funded, well-coordinated, transnational criminal organizations that go all the way from Brazil to Colombia to Bolivia. And there's a major challenge for the governments of the Amazon basin, if you consider that it is their sovereign territory, but of the planet, if you consider that everybody benefits from the Amazon, on securing these ecosystems and the people that live there.
This involves the whole range of activities: drug trafficking, illegal gold mining, which is a horrible problem, illegal logging, illegal wildlife trafficking. It the list goes on.
Yes, Alan, deforestation. We've heard of deforestation for a very long time, and it is, of course, one of the main causes for the loss of the forest. Many times people associate deforestation with cattle ranching, but honestly, I personally think that is much more behind deforestation. It is a race for the last resources. It is a land-grabbing wave that is happening right now in different countries that have national and international legal and illegal powers behind. But you know, many times you just mentioned it, mining. Mining, it's what truly goes like a cancer deep into territories and destroy communities and destroy watersheds and bring criminal organizations to the deepest, most sacred parts of the Amazon. And mining has gone up, I think it's in an 8,000% in the last 20 years. It's just mesmerizing. So there's many, many layers of pressure. And here is where... Here's where we go and get back again to the tipping point that we were mentioning, no? That people, scientific analysis says that if we lose between 20 and 25% of the Amazon system will collapse. It's like, how many pieces can you take out of an engine before it stops working? Well, it happens to be between 20 and 25% in this case. And we've destroyed already 17%. And these mining pressures are going up and deforestation pressures, they go up and down depending on the year, but they're not getting better. And you know, I personally think that before reports would say, well, we have two decades to get our act together. I personally think it's a matter of 5 years, that in 5 years we don't change some basic tendencies on what's happening on the Amazon, it's going to be very difficult to avoid the tipping point. We're still in time, but we're really walking on the precipice.
Do you know leaders who, regardless of where they live or what they do, are changing the world? Leaders who are not content with what is and are working hard for what could be. Leaders with both a demonstrated track record and the potential for continued impact. Leaders whose work is innovative, courageous, rooted in universal values, and global in approach or implication. If so, please nominate them for the Telberg SNF Eliasson Global Leadership Prize at telbergprize.org. The nominations will be open from March 15th to May 15th. Thank you.
I recently saw something by Carlos Nobre, the scientist who's done a lot of work in the Amazon. And he said that historically, the dry season in the southern Amazon lasted 3 to 4 months. It now lasts 4 to 5 months. And in his judgment, when it reaches 6 months, as he put it, that's the point when you hit the climate envelope, as you might put it, that's when the tip tips. We're almost there, whether measured by the amount of the forest that's been cut, or whether measured by the consequence of that cutting, which is the length of the dry season, which is measurably increased, not just within our lifetimes, but within a very recent period.
Absolutely. You know, I think that before, with whatever science we had, we thought that systems would change slower. They change fast. These that Carlos is a very dear friend. We work together, and Carlos knows this. And going on these bifacic, these two big seasons, which of course is like 6 months of hell and heat and fires, and then 6 months of just torrential rains. It's not melting everything that it comes across, and the consequences that it has in every sector, in every level. And remember, this is not just in the Amazon. We were just talking on the Flying River. It goes all the way from North America to South America. Even the hurricane patterns are changing in the Caribbean because of the change in rainfall patterns and water distribution from the Amazon. So yeah, it is a domino effect. And we have this data, how it's passing from 3 months to 4 months. And if we reach the 6 months, it's not a good thing. Of course.
That's an understatement. Not a good thing.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Not a good thing is a croissant that isn't quite cooked right in the morning.
Yeah.
This is something somewhat worse, I said.
I mean, it really is. I don't have the words in order to communicate out there that we really have to get efforts together now. On the good side, because I do think that there is a very good optimism as well on how to go forward.
I'd like to stay for a moment with the indigenous people.
you and your colleagues spend an awful lot of time with them amplifying their voices, I think is one way to understanding, giving them the tools they need to do what they do. How are they thinking about what's going on around them? They obviously are sensitive to the changes. They know the changes more intimately than we because they're living them.
Well, first of all, if anybody knows the Amazon and anybody knows the climate and anybody knows about climate monitoring, what are these indigenous people they have? As you say, the most sophisticated and intimate knowledge of the Amazon. And they've been spotting for decades already changes in the Amazon in the flora and fauna behavior. Changes that are affecting today as well in food production. The Amazon, let's remember, it's an amazing rainforest. It's a huge biodiversity. It looks very powerful, but it is a very fragile ecosystem. It is very poor soils, and it's a very fragile ecosystem. Any little tweak, any little change in the system has immediate results and immediate consequences. And these indigenous peoples have been spotting it. And actually, part of the work has been on how to adapt as well to these changes that climate change brings on the one hand. But on the other hand, it has been as well to leverage their environmental management strategies higher up in the government ladder in order to coordinate with other territories, be it indigenous or non-indigenous territories around them, to create these mosaics, if you want to say, you know, mosaics of conservation. Because the important thing in protecting the Amazon is not just how many hectares are protected, but how well connected it is. Connectivity is the key word here, okay? The last flying river in the northern Amazon exists because the forest is connected. Ecosystems are resilient because ecosystems are connected with other ecosystems where they can get information, energy, and resource. Everything's around connectivity. So how are indigenous people seeing it? Well, on the one hand, with a lot of concern at the local level because they're seeing the impacts. On the other hand, as they advance in their political and cultural agenda, they are reaching out to other actors and saying, okay, let's sit down and let's see how we can make this work. It's not about creating the whole Amazon in one single huge national park. It's not about creating all the Amazon in one huge indigenous territory. Here we have different actors. Let's sit down and let's get it together. Because we can measure how connectivity is getting lost and we can identify which are the hotspots. So I see indigenous organizations, one in Colombia, for instance, it is an extraordinary example on how indigenous organizations have really consolidated as local governments with full political administrative powers. They've created their own administrative agency to manage complex funds, and they're managing in a completely direct, transparent manner international funding for the protection of the Amazon. And they're coordinating amongst indigenous organizations and other partners across the Amazon. Just to give you a sense of what I talk about coordinating, in Gaia, we've supported the protection of 25 million hectares in the Colombian Amazon. That's an area the size of the UK. And within those 25 million hectares, we are supporting indigenous governments over an area of 11 million hectares. That's an area twice the size of Portugal. So it's not small scale when you have to coordinate 60 different ethnic groups are coordinating and 15 different indigenous local governments and the Colombian government and the Brazilian government. So there is a very strong drive from indigenous organizations to integrate this cross-border protection based on their own indigenous views. So they are a critical power player, stakeholder. 48% of the Amazon basin is managed by indigenous peoples. So they are, by definition, the most important stakeholder. Not the only, but the most important. One of the most important. And they're adapting. But they are as concerned as we are. Because the changes are happening as every day. And you see the changes in fish migrations, in animal migrations, in food production. And then is requiring to adapt as well other type of solutions, not non-indigenous solutions.
Concern is one thing. Action is another thing. And I know that you and your colleagues are very, very action-oriented. So what are the most important
things that can be done in the next period. And by period, I mean, you said 5 years. I suspect it could even be, needs to be faster than 5 years. To be done that can change what looks to be the inevitable fate of the North to become like the South.
Well, I think that the key strategic things that have to happen in these next years, one is that the northern region of the Amazon, the healthy forest that maintains the Fang River, that region is declared a region of strategic importance for all sovereign states in the Americas and elsewhere. But there needs to be a prioritization for all type of actor engagement in that area under a set of principles. I think that's on the one hand, and that comes together with the regional agreements. Now we have the COP30 coming up. And the COP30 is the COP in the Amazon, is the COP of the Amazon 30 years after. There's a lot of expectation, there's a lot of challenges, but it's a great opportunity for the countries of the Amazon Basin to come up with the regional agreements on how together they're going to address the challenges that they have facing the Amazon. If they don't address together the problems of organized crime, no, it will not be solved. If they don't address the problems of illegal mining, it will not be solved. It requires joint action.
But let me separate something, and it's a terribly important point. The COP, with all due respect for the COP, is not going to address illegal mining. It's not going to address the realities of what's going on, because it hasn't. This is COP 30, and we are on the precipice of the tipping point of the Amazon. I think it's ironic, and if I was even more of a cynic than I am, quite cynical to hold the COP in Belém. In one sense, I'm glad they're doing it because you're going to see what they haven't accomplished. On the other hand, all of these people who are well-meaning, they want things to be better. 80,000 people show up in Belém, or whatever number it's going to be, is not good for the Amazon. It's actually bad for the Amazon.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, no, to begin, I completely share with you, Alan. I mean, you know, we've both been in so many COPs, and, you know, a lot to be said there. And no, what caused the attention to me on this COP is that it's the first time that there is a concrete intention by the governments of the Amazon Basin, and that's why they've activated the OTCAP, the Amazon Treaty Organization, to mobilize joint elements for a joint agenda across the Amazon region. And what will be addressed in the COP is not going to be the specific elements, but actually probably a general agreement of collaboration and to create a roadmap for regional collaboration, something that there isn't today. I mean, it would sound something so straightforward, maybe to listeners in different countries. Of course, regional collaboration is important, but it's not happening everywhere, you know?
But the irony is that you've already described the regional cooperation, if you will, among the indigenous, because they don't actually probably care where the national border is. They live where they live. They understand the problems in a holistic way, and they operate on that basis. And now you have the governments over there, and they're saying, no, 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 this is Brazil, this is Colombia, this is... And that approach obviously has failed. So... I was going to use the word optimistic, but I've struck it from my vocabulary. You're hopeful that, put aside the COP, the states whose territory is the Amazon can begin collaborating and cooperating in new kinds of ways.
Yeah, it's definitely a long shot. I mean, when we say what is needed, that's one thing. Is it going to happen? That's another, you know? But identifying the Northern Amazon as a strategic region for the Americas, because the impact in social and economic terms across the whole continent from the Amazon and its flying river is determinant for the well-being of people's economies and countries, all the way from Canada to Argentina. It truly should be a strategic area for the Americas. Multilateral agreements, we have to see in that framework how it happens. And it's been super slow, and I'm skeptical about it as well. But we see what the COP30 brings and these efforts that the Colombian government is doing and the Brazilian government is doing. Lula has lost a little bit of weight because of his intentions to exploit oil in the delta of the Amazon. And you know, I mean, Congress in Brazil is not exactly pro-Amazon, it's more pro-conventional development. So there's so many layers to this, but there is
a basis of political will in the region, where you have presidents like Petro in Colombia and Lula in Brazil that have an Amazonian agenda, despite the internal challenges they have. Well, let's see where that takes us. But bringing back again to what are we doing and what is the way forward? I mentioned the collaboration between indigenous peoples and as well between organizations of civil society. Gaia Amazonas, we've been over 30 years working shoulder to shoulder with indigenous communities and different governments on building solutions, intercultural solutions that bring the best of the indigenous world and sometimes when needed, the best of the non-indigenous world. And there's been a lot of time, efforts, time, money, in thinking invested in creating very high impact solutions that actually work. I mean, in Gaia, I was just mentioning to you, we're working empowering indigenous local governments from A to Z over an area twice the size of Portugal. That by definition is to act at scale. So how can we put our expertise in service for others? How can we accelerate these scaling up processes? And that's where we've joined efforts with other leading and pioneering civil society organizations in the Northern Amazon specifically. And we created a network called the North Amazon Alliance. And the objective of this network is to identify the high impact solutions that have been replicated, do the capacity sharing to scale them up as fast as possible in order to accelerate in the next 4 or 5 years, how can we consolidate the protection of this mosaic of strategies in the Northern Amazon. And for instance, today with the Northern Amazon, we're working, one of the programs that we have on indigenous governance tools is over an area the size of France. So there is ways to scale up high impact solutions. The actors are there, the expertise are there, solutions are there. Many times political will is what really falls short. And of course, another element now is the whole world of international cooperation and financing that brings another layer of challenges.
Part of the reason I wanted to have this conversation is that the work you've been doing, the work that Guy's been doing, is a wonderful example of what I consider bottom up, working on the ground with communities, with people, trying to build solutions as opposed to a more top-down approach. We probably need both. The top-down too often imposes things that aren't appropriate and don't work. So I want to thank you for this conversation. I also want to thank you guys, and by you guys, I mean you, your father, your colleagues, who have built Gaia Amazonas into something that actually makes a difference.
Thank you so much, Alan. And good day, afternoon, evening, whoever you are, wherever you are. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of New Thinking for a New World. I'm Alan Stoga, podcast host, and I look forward to your joining our next conversation. Remember, tell us what you think at telbergfoundation.org.